Thanks very much, David, for that kind introduction. David doesn't know this, but my one of my pet topics is US politics. And so actually, I can tell you that as of this, and Candy Wolf may disabuse you of this later on, but at least as of this morning, according to Nate Silver, who's the sort of preeminent, in my view at least, the preeminent political pundit in the US, at the moment, it looks like the Republicans are gaining ground in the Senate but losing ground in the House. So, and Supreme Court justice nominations apparently have sent those two things in opposite directions. So you can try and maybe you can ask her later on how that works anyway. But at least as of the moment, it looks like the Democrats are going to get the House and the Republicans are probably going to hold on to the Senate. So that's my vote on that one. But today I'm going to talk about something a bit different. I'm going to talk about the state of the Australian labour market. And so what I want to do is just run you through a few different ways of looking at the labour market and draw together some conclusions as to how it's travelling at the moment and where it might go in the next little while. So over the past year, there have been some very welcome developments in the Australian labour market. Employment has grown strongly. The participation rate is close to its highest level on record, and the unemployment rate has declined to be at a six-year low. And that's all consistent with the above-trend GDP growth that we've got in the economy at the moment. But despite these improvements, there is still spare capacity in the labour market. Unemployment, the unemployment rate, is higher than is desirable, and a number of workers would like to work more hours than they're currently on offer. And that the high level of unemployment and underemployment is a large part of the explanation for the low wages growth that we've seen in recent years. So as detailed in our most recent statement on monetary policy, we anticipate that GDP will continue to grow above trend over the next few years, which will see the unemployment rate decline further. That in turn should see wages growth pick up, providing a welcome boost to household income. So the dynamics at play in the labour market are important considerations for monetary policy. Full employment, as you know, is an objective for the RBA in and of itself, and the state of the labour market has a significant influence on the achievement of the RBA's inflation target. So it's important, obviously, for us to have a pretty good, spend a lot of time looking at the labour market and trying to work out what's going on. So today I'm going to look at the labour market from a number of different angles. I'll begin with the employment data, then discuss unemployment and wages before turning to the outlook for the labour market. So in analysing the labour market, it is important to not get hung up on one month's data. So we're going to get some new data tomorrow, and I would caution about over-analysing one month's worth of data. Just to remind you that the standard error on the change in employment each month is plus or minus 30,000. That's one standard error, plus or minus 30,000. So that's not very big if you're looking at the level of employment, but it is big when you're looking at a change which averages around about plus or minus 15,000 to 20,000. So the sort of short-term gyrations are great for high-frequency trading, but they're not so great for trying to get a good handle on what's actually going on in the economy. So it's much more useful to look at the trends in the various labour market data, look at them in a number of different ways, check that they are consistent, and identify and hopefully resolve any anomalies. And I'll talk a bit about some of that going forward. So while some of you might want to trade off the headline tomorrow, if you're looking for a more medium-term strategy, I'd advise you just look through the headline and spend a little bit more time before working out where you're going to position yourself as a result. So employment has grown by 2.5% over the past year. Okay, there we go. So while I've shown these, this is the data shown in trend terms, doesn't mean that I actually think the trend as published by the ABS is necessarily the most useful way of looking at things, because it has its own problems, particularly endpoint problems. But nevertheless, it's a useful way of trying to show the general state of affairs without getting hung up on the short-term volatility. But as you can see there, employment's grown by 2.5% over the past year. And that's at the high end of historical outcomes, as you can see there. And if I went back even further, then it would still very much be at the high end of historical outcomes in terms of employment growth. You can also see there, I split that up into full-time and part-time. Over two-thirds of the increase in employment over the past 2 years has been in full-time work. Despite that, part-time employment as a share of total employment remains close to its historic highs at around one-third of employment. So quite a lot is often made of the full versus part-time distinction, often with the unstated presumption that full-time jobs are better than part-time jobs. But of the one-third of the workforce which works part-time, three-quarters of them do so because that's what they want to do. So it's not that part-time jobs are I'm sure this is not so surprising, but it's not that part-time jobs are necessarily involuntarily part-time. They're there because that's what people want to do, and that's what the employers, and that also suits the employers too. So some of those part-time workers do want to work more hours, but generally they want to work more hours in a part-time job. They don't want a full-time job. So really the important issue is not so much the full-time, part-time split, and at least over the course of this year, generally there's a correlation of around about minus one between those two things month to month. So again, don't get hung up on the short-term gyrations in that. The important issue is really whether there are enough jobs generating enough hours that people actually want to work. So at the same time as there's been above average employment growth, the participation rate has increased and is now close to its record high. So movements in the participation rate have been highly correlated with employment growth for some time now, although this doesn't have to be the case. And I'm going to invoke Chris Caton, who worked for a number of companies in this country, but not Citibank. But anyway, I'll invoke Chris Caton in noting that you should always avoid statements like, if the participation rate hadn't increased, the unemployment rate would have been lower. Both the rise in the participation rate and the lower unemployment rate increase labour utilisation and reduce the amount of spare capacity in the labour market. So to some extent, if you think about our overall objective of full employment for the economy, it doesn't matter too much to us whether that comes because the unemployment rate's going down or the participation rate's going up. Both of them are increasing the amount of labour utilisation in the economy, and both of them are moving us closer towards full employment. The rise in the participation rate has both structural and cyclical elements. Some part of the rise is occurring because each generation of women in Australia are participating more in the labour force than previous cohorts did at the same age. Now, this effect has fully run its course in the US, but doesn't look like it's quite run its course in Australia, although we're probably getting close to the end of it. Some of the rise in the participation rate is because more people have joined or deferred leaving the labour force over recent years as employment opportunities have improved. In particular, the participation rates of older workers and females have increased notably in recent years. Particularly in the case of older workers, it very much looks like they're not leaving the workforce as early as they did in the past. It's not that they're coming back into the labour force, they're just not leaving. Now, whether that's voluntary or involuntary is not entirely clear. So if you're living longer, then you're probably going to be working longer, and it's not clear whether you're working longer because you have to work longer because you've got a longer period of life after you finish working, or because you want to work longer because you haven't got anything else to do. But either of those two things, that's what's going on. The participation rates of older workers are going up and seem to be staying up. So as I said, as this shows, employment growth has been strong over the past year. So what sectors of the employment of the economy have actually underpinned this strong growth? So what I've done here is taken employment in a few industries and just shown you what's going on. It's important to remember there are two ways of looking at this. So this data comes from the Labour Force Survey, and that asks households which industry they work in. So the ABS knocks on the door or rings you up and asks you, the household, which industry you work in. But there's another source of data which is similar to that of the payrolls in the US, where they actually ask the firms, which industry are you working in and how many people do you employ? So just recently, or fairly recently now, the ABS has started publishing the labour account data, and that gets the employment information from the businesses. And as I said, it's similar to the payrolls data in the US. And depending on which one you ask, you get different answers, and I'll come back to that in a second. But this data comes from the Labour Force Survey, and it shows that the industries that contribute the most to employment growth over the past 2 years are healthcare and social assistance, so that purple line, construction, which is on the right-hand side there, and perhaps somewhat surprisingly, manufacturing. So The increase in health-related jobs is probably not much of a surprise. It reflects both long-term trends such as ageing of the population as well as the rollout of the NDIS over the past couple of years. Construction employment is close to 10% of total employment at the moment, and this is around its highest share of employment since the 1920s. So construction as a share of employment is about the highest it's been since the 1920s, as best as we can tell, which has been supported by the large amount of activity in residential and infrastructure construction, particularly happening in this part of the world. But as you can see there, there's also been a noteworthy increase in manufacturing employment in the last little while, and that's a result of export demand for high-quality food and wine, and as well as demand for manufactured goods from mining-related activity, as well as the high levels of residential and infrastructure constructions. In particularly the latter, there's been quite a big spillover from infrastructure to the domestic manufacturing sector. So the most recent pickup in manufacturing employment takes it back to its level around 2011. So having been on a long-term decline for around about 3 or 4 decades, manufacturing employment has actually started to rise again, as I said, is back to where it was about 7 years ago. The other line there, which is PST services, that's professional scientific and tech services, basically IT employment, and that, not surprisingly, has also grown strongly over the past year, and that reflects employment both in the IT industry and in the management consulting industry. But as I said, if you look at it, cut it from another way, the labour account data provide an alternative perspective on where the jobs growth has been. For example, businesses report that the number of jobs in construction has not increased anywhere near the extent that households have reported over recent years. And that may be because construction workers hired or contracted out by a labour hire or business services company will not be recorded as construction workers in the labour account. So if you ask the household where they're working, they'll say they're working in construction. If you ask the firm where they're working, they'll say we're working in business services. And so again, depending on who you're asking, you're going to get a slightly different answer. Similarly, in answering a household survey, someone working for a professional services company who is deployed to a bank may think of themselves as working in the finance sector rather than in professional services. There's no right way of measuring this. It just depends on who you ask and what question you're trying to answer. But notwithstanding that, the general point that a lot of the jobs growth has been in household services, more recently in business services, been pretty strong growth in IT, and that there's been there's been a decent rebound in manufacturing jobs over the last little while. So what jobs have been created in terms of pay? So again, one of the stories which is often out there that all the jobs that have been created are low wage, part-time, which is said with the underlying presumption part-time is bad, jobs. So drawing on the data from the more than 450 occupations tracked by the ABS, our assessment is employment growth has actually been reasonably evenly distributed across pay levels over recent years. So there's been pretty even growth in jobs right across the pay distribution. They certainly haven't been all low-wage jobs. There have been relatively strong employment growth in occupations with above-average rates of pay, such as jobs within healthcare, IT, and engineering. But within the household services sector, employment growth has been strongest in occupations with below-average wages. So it is true that where some of the jobs have been in the household services sector has tended to be in low-wage jobs, which includes bar attendants and baristas, waiters, child carers, and age and disability carers. But it's not just been those jobs, it's been right across the whole wage distribution, depending on which sector you're working in. It's also difficult to get a good read on the prevalence of the gig economy jobs. The share of people working as independent contractors has actually declined a little over the past decade. The share of people working casual jobs is also little changed. And the labour account data do report information on workers with more than one job, and it suggests that secondary jobs, i.e. people who've got primary jobs and then working another job on the side, account for around 6% of total jobs, but that hasn't changed much over the past 5 years. So there's nothing obvious in there which tells us that has become more or less prevalent over recent years. So having talked about employment, let me switch to talking about unemployment. So the aggregate unemployment rate has fallen over 1 percentage point since its recent peak in October 2014, and it's now at its lowest level in 6 years. And it's fallen from its peak across all states and territories, although as you can see there in WA, it's moved back up again recently. Recently, we've seen strong declines in the unemployment rates of in Victoria in particular, and also South Australia. So I'd just like to take the opportunity of having the stage to point out that if you look at that purple line there, South Australia now has the third lowest unemployment rate in the country. So I'm from South Australia, is why I'm doing this, for the first time since 2012. And it's fallen over 2 percentage points since its peak. So there's actually a pretty good story going on in South Australia over the last few years, particularly, and it's, some of it's related to what I was talking about earlier in terms of manufacturing and particularly in the food and wine sector. But anyway, the other thing you can see there, so in, the labour market in South Australia and Victoria have improved quite noticeably. The other interesting thing to think in looking at Victoria is that up until quite recently, Victoria had an unemployment rate of 6%, coming at the same time as employment growth was around about 3%. This was to the great chagrin of Tim Pallas, the Victorian Treasurer, who would say, I've got the fastest growing labour market in the country, but all that the commentators want to focus on is the fact that we have an unemployment rate of 6% still. Well, now he's got the fastest labour market in the strongest labour market in the country and an unemployment rate of around about 5%. But there was just so many people coming into Victoria, it took them a few weeks to find a job as they came in, so the unemployment rate held up even in the face of very strong employment growth. And again, one thing that shows is you can't just look at unemployment and you can't just look at employment, you need to look at them both together. So the recent decline in the unemployment rate has also been broad-based across all age groups in the economy. The unemployment rate of younger people has recorded the sharpest fall over the past year. So the youth unemployment rate tends to be more sensitive to economic conditions than the unemployment rate of other age groups. Despite this, the share of younger part-time workers who want to work more hours than they currently do remains high. And furthermore, the share of 20 to 24-year-olds that are not in employment nor full-time in education or training remains higher than it was a decade ago. So while there's been a decline in unemployment rates across all the age groups, there's still a fair bit more room for improvement, particularly in the youth unemployment rate. Another way of cutting unemployment is to look at the duration of unemployment. The median duration of unemployment, so how long what's the median duration of the time you're unemployed, has declined over the past year to be around 15 weeks. There has been a noteworthy decline recently in those who have been unemployed for between a quarter and a year. So that's the purple line in the middle. That's the one which has come down recently as the unemployment rates come down. But as you can see there, the long-term unemployment rate has not fallen much and has remained around about 1.25% of the labour force, which is somewhat was particularly concerning given the adverse social and economic consequences that arise from long-term unemployed. So while it's a welcome development that we've seen this decline in medium-term unemployment, the short-term unemployment rate is probably what you would say is more just a sort of churn unemployment rate. But we haven't quite seen we haven't yet got to the point where the long-term unemployment rate is declining. That said, generally sustained improvement in the economy, the sort of which we're in the middle of at the moment, does result in time in a decline in the average duration of unemployment and of the long-term unemployed. Again, just going through the unemployment rates by duration and by age gives you a different cut on what's going on in the labour market. So at 5.3%, at least as of today, I don't know where it necessarily will be tomorrow, the unemployment rate is above our estimates of the NAIRU. But we also closely monitor broader measures of underutilisation. So in that regard, here are some useful facts to keep in mind when you're thinking about unemployment or underemployment. So around one quarter of part-time workers are actively looking to work more hours. So remember, part-time workers are one-third of employment, around one quarter of them are actively looking to work more hours than they currently do. On average, they are seeking to work an extra 2 days a week. So your average part-time job is around about 2 days a week. Those people who want to work more hours, they don't want to work a full-time job, they just want to work 2 extra days on average. So work 4 days a week rather than 2 days a week. So we can take that information that comes from that and combine it with the unemployment rate and come up with this underutilization rate. So the underemployment rate is taking account of the fact that part-timers want to work more jobs. You add that to the standard unemployment rate, there's people who don't have jobs but are actively looking, and you come up with the underutilisation rate. So while the underemployment rate has trended higher over time alongside the increased prevalence of part-time work, so remember the number of part-time workers has gone up, so there's much more capacity for them to want to work more hours, movements in the unemployment rate, as you can see there, still remain by far the dominant driver of movements in the broader underutilisation rate. So from my point of view, while I've spent a fair bit of time saying you've got to look at all aspects of the labour market, if you had to boil it down to one statistic, I still think the unemployment rate is the most useful summary indicator of the state of the labour market. So the underemployment rate does move around a bit at a sort of lower frequency horizon, but on a higher frequency high to medium frequency horizon, the unemployment rate is probably still the most useful summary statistic of what's going on in the labour market. So given what you can see here in terms of spare capacity in the labour market, it's not so surprising that wages growth has been subdued. So we monitor there are a number of available measures of labour costs as they each capture slightly different concepts of wages growth. So I'll just show you the different measures, a few of the different measures here. So there's the wage price index, which is the red line, which measures the change in the average hourly wage rate for a given job compared to the same job in the previous period, and importantly excludes any changes to the nature of the job. So it's the same as the employment cost index in the US. It's a like-for-like measure of changes in wages for a particular job, not for a person, but for a job. In contrast, the national accounts measure of average earnings per hour and average weekly ordinary time earnings are broader in scope. They basically measure the wage bill. So there are growth in the average wage per worker. They embody changes to the composition of the labour force. For example, if you have someone moving from a high-paid to a low-paid job, that's going to pick that up. It's not going to be picked up in the wage price index. It's going to be picked up in a WOTI or in average earnings per hour. So those two move around a fair bit more as a result of compositional changes. And that makes them more volatile than the WPI. They probably, in the end, better capture in the inflationary pressures stemming from labour costs. You don't pay the wage price index, you pay people average weekly earnings or you pay them average earnings per hour. That's what's going into labour costs more directly, not the wage price index. Notwithstanding a few different ways of looking at it, on any of the measures, wages growth has been low over the past few years. And one of the factors contributing to this is the low level of voluntary job turnover. So, not as you probably possibly all know from personal experience, you tend to choose to leave your job for a better job, be it in conditions or pay. At the moment, the level of voluntary turnover in the labour force is around about as low as it's ever been historically. People just aren't shifting voluntarily from one job to another. They're actually not shifting much involuntarily either. The fact that little of this is occurring is probably a fairly major contributor to the subdued wages growth. Again, it's another way of getting a sense of what the state of the labour market is. That said, recently some of our liaison contacts are now reporting that turnover is increasing. But as the labour market has tightened, they're not necessarily paying people more, they're just finding ways to paying their whole workforce more, they're finding ways to retain some of their employees or attract employees without raising wages for everyone. So many businesses in our liaison program report that they're linking wage growth outcomes to individual performance rather than paying the same wage outcome across the whole workforce, providing them the flexibility to reward and retain strong performance while keeping averages wages growth contained. The use of bonuses, I suppose it's something familiar to bankers, at least historically, not necessarily going forward, especially to retain key staff, is also prevalent. It's something which the rest of the workforce doesn't have quite so much experience as you lot all do. But the use of bonuses is becoming a lot more prevalent, which again serves to not permanently raise labour costs. It's just a once-off payment. Some firms are attempting to retain staff by using non-wage incentives, including flexible work arrangements, providing them with equity, subsidised gym memberships and additional annual leave. So those things aren't flowing through into something like the WPI, but they do end up in sort of an aggregate measure of labour costs, although they're not necessarily ongoing. They may be just once-off. That said, we are hearing this is becoming increasingly more prevalent, and one might expect that as it becomes more prevalent, you might actually have to start paying everyone a little bit more rather than just a select few. But as you can see here, pretty much, all of the wage measures indicate that a slight pickup in growth has occurred recently. We do seem to have passed a turning point in wages growth. This increase has been broad-based across most industries, although it's been modest in all cases. So what I've shown here, this is just looking at the wage price index. And as I said, at the moment, the fact there's not actually much turnover in the economy means the wage price, job turnover in the economy means the wage price index is actually giving a pretty decent read as to what's actually going on in terms of wages pressure. So what we've got here, the orange dot is where wage growth was on average a year ago. The blue bar is where it is on the most recent reading. And you can see that most of the blue bars, not all, but most of the blue bars are to the right of the orange dot. You can see one notable exception there is retail. Now, there's a few things going on which are going to affect retail wage outcomes, and probably mostly already have, but may be recorded in the next number, which comes out. Firstly, that around one quarter of all employees in total, but disproportionately in retail, will have received a 3.5% pay rise following the increase in the national minimum wage on 1st of July. Secondly, there's been a couple of extremely large retail employees who have just reached wage outcomes with their staff. So for a long time, their staff had actually been experiencing wage freezes, so zero outcomes. Now they've actually got positive outcomes. One of them is done, and the other one, I think, is pretty close to done. So after having a long period in retail where at least the two largest employers had zero wage outcomes, we're now looking at something, it will be a positive number, which again probably will shift that blue bar somewhat to the right. So again, this gives you an idea that wage growth is picking up, but it's only pretty gradual. As you can see, if you look at the scale here, this is only going from 0 to 3, and the increases we're seeing are one point something to somewhere around the vicinity of 2. So it's hardly off to the races at this point. So that's what's going on in terms of wages. Let me now turn to the outlook for the labour market. So a number of ways we come up to this. One is just the outlook, obviously, for the economy as a whole. But there are also a number of useful leading indicators that we use to try and get some idea about where the labour market might be going. So here's a whole bunch of vacancy-based measures of the labour market. So there's always uncertainty around our forecast, but at the moment there are a few conflicting signals from the various measures of labour demand. So job vacancies data and business survey hiring intentions have recorded strong growth. So you can particularly see that on the right-hand side, that employment intentions from the NAB survey are about as high as they ever get. But there's been, if you look at the orange line there, the job advertisements put together by ANZ, there's been very little growth in that data over the last little while. So while divergences in the signal from the various activity measures are not unusual, the divergences between vacancies and job advertisements has been steadily increasing over recent years. And this in part reflects changes in the way that businesses recruit and workers search for jobs. For example, the job ads data capture the main online recruitment websites, so they don't just sit there and count up ads in the newspapers, particularly not really many there anymore. But they're not picking up, so they are looking at the main online recruitment websites, but they're not picking up newer recruitment sites or the use of social media sites such as LinkedIn. So the usefulness of the orange line there, the job ad series, may be declining. Large corporations are also maintaining expression of interest registers on their own website. So workers are going directly to the corporate websites to find the job rather than going through an intermediary. And that reduces the need of those corporations to advertise to fill a vacancy. And again, that would explain why you get a difference between what's going on the right-hand side there and what's going on the orange line. The ABS vacancies series is more of a survey of companies, again, as to what their vacancies are. And again, that's why it looks a little more consistent with what's in the right-hand panel. Taking all of the information from these various indicators together suggests that employment is likely to grow a bit above its long-term average over the next 6 months. And that's consistent with our forecast that GDP will also grow a bit above trend. Another way of looking at what's going on in terms of the future of the direction of the labour market is to look at the beverage curve. So empirically, which I'll show you here, empirically there's a negative relationship between the number of job vacancies. So what we've got here is the vacancy rate on the y-axis and the unemployment rate on the x-axis. So this is what's commonly known in the economics profession, at least, as the beverage curve. So generally, you can see there's pretty much a downward sloping line to this. So the vacancy rate, when the vacancy rate's higher, the unemployment rate tends to be lower. But you can have, but at various points in time, you can have rises in vacancies, which take a little while to translate into a decline in unemployment, and the opposite when the labour market's going the opposite direction. Empirically, there's a negative relationship, though, between the number of job vacancies and the number of unemployed persons. And over the past few years, as you can see there, so 2018, this is quarterly data, 2018 are those three dark blue dots right at the top of the screen. So the vacancy rate is as high as it's ever been relative to the unemployment rate. So what that's saying is that, so there's been a large increase in vacancies, but given that increase in vacancies, only a fairly small decline in unemployment over the last 9 months or so. That is, firms are hiring fewer workers per job opening or vacancy than has been typical. So a possible explanation for this is an increasing skill mismatch between unemployed workers and available jobs. So structural changes in the labour market are a result to changes to participation, technological change, or those coming from something, a shock such as the mining boom, can contribute to a mismatch. Lower mobility, either geographical or at the job level, can also reduce the ability of firms to find the appropriate worker. Yet, I don't think at the moment geographic mobility has probably got much to do with it, because what we've actually seen is some fairly large net interstate migration flows as conditions in the labour market have varied. So as I mentioned earlier, there's been a very large inflow of workers into Victoria, given how strong the labour market is there. And there's been a very large outflow of workers from WA. So WA had a big inflow, then at the peak of the mining boom. After the mining boom, it's now experiencing a very large outflow. So the swings in population growth in WA have been of the order of 2-3 percentage points, so extremely large. So the labour market has actually done a pretty good job in terms of interstate migration in evening out some of the differences between state labour markets. And if you think back to that graph I showed you earlier, the gap between unemployment rates across states is about as low as it gets in Australia at the moment. So geographic mismatch is probably not contributing much to the story here. So it's not entirely clear what's driving this. It may reflect some underinvestment in training over recent years, which is contributing to a bit of, particularly in technical skills, which may be contributing to a skill mismatch. That said, the vacancy rate, as you can see here, is at its highest relative to the size of the labour market that we've ever seen. That too is a very positive signal for the labour market outlook. So to sum up, the labour market, I've tried to look at the labour market in a number of different ways in terms of employment, unemployment, underemployment, wages and vacancies. All of those indicators say that the labour market is in pretty good shape. Employment growth is above average, the participation rate is at a high level, the vacancy rate is at an all-time high, and the unemployment rate is falling. However, as I showed too, the long-term unemployment rate has been little changed of late and wages growth remains low. The near-term indicators suggest demand for labour remains above average and the expected growth in the economy over the next few years should gradually reduce the spare capacity in the labour market. As we have said many times, we expect that will lead to a gradual increase in wages growth and, in turn, inflation. There are a number of uncertainties about the extent and timing of the decline in the unemployment rate and the expected pickup in wages growth. So one thing we can look at from the recent international experience, is that the unemployment rate could decline further than historical experience would suggest before we see a material increase in wages growth. We're only getting that now in the US a long time after most people expected it to occur. But against this, further increases in labour demand, in Australia at least, may be met more from the pool of unemployed rather than from people not currently in the labour force. So as I said, we've seen a very large increase in the participation rate, which is, again, still absorbing spare capacity in the labour market. It's not entirely, we just don't know how much more that's got to run. So what we may see from here, it's conceivable, is that we actually see more of a decline in the unemployment rate. And it might decline faster than we expect. So those two uncertainties go in opposite directions. But whichever way you cut it, I think the main conclusion to draw is that the labour market is actually in pretty decent shape, with the prospect to be in even better shape in the near future. So with that, let me finish there. Thanks. All right, so I can take some questions. I will take some questions even. So, and if you do ask a question, could you please identify who you are? Because I can't see who you are from here. So,
It's Rory Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury. Dr. Bell, thanks for your talk. I know nothing I or anyone else says about South Australia will diminish your love for it. You noted that South Australia has the lowest unemployment rate among small populated states. Have you also noticed that South Australia has the weakest business conditions of any state, having recently taken over from Western Australia? That's not my question. That's just a bit of fun. In the past year, as you've highlighted, the Australian economy's done well. The GDP growth's been above trend. Employment growth's above trend. You know, NAB survey economy-wide business conditions are above trend. Unemployment's edging lower. So that's all good. The other feature of the economy has been that, average house prices have fallen 3 or 4%. Housing credit growth has slowed a lot. So there's a bit of a pessimistic view out there that the weakness in the housing sector ultimately will drag the economy down. Why hasn't that happened so far? And, is that a likely scenario?
Thanks, Rory. So I was actually back in Adelaide boosting the economy on the weekend. I can tell you things are actually travelling pretty nicely there, regardless of what NAB surveys suggest, and actually the mood there is as optimistic as it's been in 30 years. In terms of your question on, that's a risk that what you say, and that's one of the risks that we highlight around our outlook. I suppose just a couple of things to put what's going on in the housing market in perspective. So house prices are declining. David got you all to, everyone apparently, not surprisingly in this room, at least seemed to know that number. It's the one number everyone seems to know, so it gets a fair bit of visibility. It's also worthwhile putting that in a little bit of perspective. Amongst other things, it's not declining in every market, housing market in Australia. The aforementioned South Australia would be one place where house prices are not actually falling. So not all of the country lives in Sydney. The other point to note is that it's also to put it in context in terms of what happened before that. So as I think a number of you may be including quite painfully aware, that house prices went up a long way here before they've actually come down. So they've come down, I think in Sydney, more like 6-7% on average from their peak, having gone up sort of 50% in a few years. So I think that's one thing to bear in mind. It's not entirely clear how much of a boost the rise in house prices provided to the economy on the way up, which also means it's not entirely clear how much of a drag it may provide or may constitute on the way down. I'm not saying that because I think one way or the other. It's really an uncertainty. The other thing to bear in mind on the lending side is lending has slowed, as you note. It's pretty much slowed. It's slowed almost entirely. It's been concentrated in the investor market. So investor lending is pretty much is slowed to around about zero at the moment. But lending to owner-occupiers is still trending happily, chugging along at sort of 6-6.5%, which is not particularly slow. So the composition of of credit has changed from investors to owner-occupiers, and probably in part a function of the of the change dynamics of house prices. Falling house prices are more attractive to owner-occupiers than they are to investors. So lending has slowed, but it's still, for at least two-thirds of the market, still travelling along at a pretty comfortable rate. But it has slowed quite dramatically for investors. So, again, all of that means that, yes, it's something that we're paying pretty close attention to. How much of a drag it may constitute to the economy is just not clear. So, because going on the other side, you've got pretty strong employment growth and hopefully some pickup in wages growth in prospect to provide a boost to household income, which provides an offset in the other direction.
Thank you.
Thanks. Right down the back.
Hi, good morning. Luke Theobald, Citibank. A quick question. Obviously, there's a lot of focus on the number of full-time and part-time jobs, but has there been any research into whether the labour productivity growth rates between full-time jobs, part-time jobs, and perhaps full-time jobs with flexi hours are a material difference, and if that could have potential impact on long-term growth rates? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, one thing which is, in terms of productivity, one thing which is useful, particularly for those of you who are not from Australia here today. So the productivity growth story in Australia is actually quite a bit different from that, particularly in the US in that, and the UK, in that we've had reasonable employment growth while still reasonable, not stellar, but still decent productivity growth. So productivity, whereas in the US, it's been very strong employment growth and almost no productivity growth. So in Australia, we've actually had productivity going along at an okay rate. To answer your question, the answer is complicated by the fact that actually where the growth has been, particularly in health services and the like, productivity growth is extremely difficult to measure. The ABS does an okay, as good a job as they can of measuring it, but measuring productivity growth in the healthcare sector, in the education sector, where a lot of the jobs growth has been, is extremely fraught. And so the answer is, to your question, is we don't really know. You can split up productivity by sector, but the information is not necessarily all that useful. As I said, in aggregate, though, productivity growth in Australia has been decent. Could be stronger, but it's certainly not the same sort of situation as you're seeing in the US or the UK. Right. Sorry, I can't see you. Paul.
Guy, it's Paul Brennan from Citi. Thanks very much, Guy, for being our keynote speaker at our 10th annual investment conference in Australia. My question was regarding types of wage negotiations. I think the ACTU is talking about a desire to shift wage bargaining from more micro to more macro, so industry-wide bargaining. Given your comments that, you know, a lot of the wage rises that we've been seeing have been very micro-based, just wondering how potentially we could see a shift to industry-wide bargaining. Potentially that could mean maybe higher wage growth in aggregate, but potentially it could also mean that could be at the cost of lower employment growth, which is, as you point out, has been very strong. So just wondering whether, you've got any thoughts on that issue.
I'm not sure I have too much directly on that. I mean, what we have seen, though, is that wage outcomes have been... So which, if you cut it... One thing I didn't show is if you can cut it by the different forms of wage bargaining, and the outcomes actually aren't all that different, whether you're under an EBA, an enterprise bargaining agreement, whereas a contract or whatever. You could see it in the industry data. There's just not much difference in wage outcomes across the different sectors of the economy at the moment. That's about as low as it ever gets in terms of dispersion. So what that means is it doesn't really matter. We've seen a number of enterprise bargains which are something closer to what you're talking about, which have delivered particularly low wage outcomes. Some of them are starting to pick up a little bit, but only a little bit. And in fact, in some of those, they've been getting lower wage outcomes than other parts of the economy. So it's not obvious to me that cutting it by the sort of wage bargaining stream is necessarily going to, at least in the near term, is going to have too much of an impact on things. So I can take one more if anyone wants to ask one more before we run out of time. Going to go back to the well, Rory.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. Guy... the Australian dollar, at sort of the peak of the resources boom, got to about, I think, 80 on a TWI reading. It's now in the low 60s, so down about 20% nominal TWI. How helpful has that been to the economy? And are you hopeful that, as the Fed sort of continues to normalise interest rates, that the Aussie dollar might go lower and help, the unemployment rate here to go lower?
Since it came down from... 80 on a TWI base, $1.10 against the US dollar. So the fact that we're sort of 25-30% lower than that is unambiguously helpful. I think in the last few years, I mean, the exchange rates actually traded a pretty narrow range, as actually most exchange rates have globally. And we're at the lower end of that range at the moment, and that's better than the alternative. It's probably providing a little bit of a boost, but I don't think I'd overstate the sort of movements we've seen of late in terms of contributing much to economic outcomes. It's helpful, but not as much as the sort of 25-30% depreciation we saw prior to that. as the Fed raises rate, you know, as the Fed raises rates, waiting for the currency to go lower. Well, I mean, sort of waited for that for quite a long time. Maybe that day is finally here. But if your trading strategy was based on that, you wouldn't have been particularly in the money over the last few years. And that's true of any number of currencies, not just the Australian dollar, that interest differentials have widened between the US and everyone else in the world, and the US's dollar has gone up a little bit, but not as much as you would have probably expected, given the size of the widening in interest differentials. So, you know, if it would, that would be helpful if the Fed does indeed continue to raise rates, that can, you know, helps deliver a lower currency here, that will certainly boost, you know, be helpful for the economy and also for us in terms of achieving the inflation objective. I'm not going to. I'm not 100% confident that's actually going to happen. As I said, we've been waiting for that for quite a long period of time. Maybe it's finally here now. But that said, we're still only just at the sort of bottom end of the range we've been in for the last 2-3 years on a trade-weighted basis. A lower currency would certainly be useful in terms of providing a bit more impetus to the economy and to inflation, but it's not something we can bank on. All right, so let me leave it there. Thanks, everyone.